Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome to Counterpunch Radio. I'm your program producer, Nathaniel St. Clair, and today's episode is brought to you in partnership with Verso Books. You know Verso. For over 50 years, they have published important works of theory, history, philosophy, and criticism from the left. A recent title of theirs that I highly recommend is The Captain's Coup, From Dictatorship to Democracy in Portugal, by Wilford Burchett. This is the first English edition of a legendary journalist eyewitness account of the near bloodless coup and the Carnation Revolution that ended fascism in Portugal. Wilford Burchett went to Lisbon in 1974 to cover the military overthrow of the fascist dictatorship that had ruled the country for nearly five decades. His on-the-ground reporting details the immediate aftermath of the coup and the civilian uprising that followed, which took its name, the Carnation Revolution, from the flowers demonstrators handed out to soldiers and placed in the muzzle of their rifles. The people's victory began a transition to democracy. It prompted the withdrawal of troops from Portugal's colonies, bringing independence to Guinea-Bissau and soon to Angola, Mozambique, and other colonial territories. On the 50th anniversary of the revolution's end, The Captain's Coup offers an insightful, poignant narrative, never before available in English, from a journalist of international repute. The text is based on the author's original typescripts, discovered recently in the National Library of Australia. You can find The Captain's Coup at versobooks.com, where Counterpunch Radio listeners can save 20% by using discount code Counterpunch at checkout. All right, on today's episode, Joshua Frank and Eric Wallenberg welcome Mike Preisner to the show. Mike is a writer and producer for Empire Files. He's been an incredible organizer of anti-war veterans since his return from service in the Iraq War. He hosts his own podcast about the military called Eyes Left, and has recently co-directed a documentary about U.S. military pollution titled Earth's Greatest Enemy. They cover his time in the military, what led him to becoming an anti-war advocate, the history and current reality of organizing in the military. They talk about the dismantling of veteran benefits by Trump and Musk, and they touch on his new film, Earth's Greatest Enemy, which digs deep into how the U.S. military remains the planet's biggest polluter. But before we get to that, I won't give you a peek at the paid portion of our website, though I do encourage you to take a look yourself. What I will do is ask for your support in our spring fund drive. As I'm sure you know, Counterpunch is a reader-powered publication. Every week, we publish nearly 100 articles, and we've been doing that for 30 years now, because of you. Your support has ensured that critical journalism, the kind you won't find anywhere near mainstream media, has continued to shine a light on all the dark shit powerful countries and people don't want seen or heard or thought about. And I genuinely don't think there has been a time in my life where the need for independent, unflinching, uncompromised journalism has been more vital and under more threat of getting snuffed out. We are fighting to keep it alive, but we need all the support we can get, and we need it now. So, if you have the means to chip in, please head over to the donation page on our website. We are deeply, deeply grateful for every contribution. All right, let's get to what you came here for. Eric and Joshua in conversation with Mike Preisner.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the
Welcome to Counterpunch Radio. This is Joshua Frank, and I'm joined by my co-host, Eric Wallenberg. And we're very excited to have my friend Mike Preisner with us today. Mike, along with his partner, Abby Martin, is a writer and producer of The Empire Files, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with. It's a great media source. And since returning from the Iraq War, he has been an organizer of anti-war veterans and service members. He hosts a military podcast, which I also highly recommend, called Eyes Left. And he is co-director of the upcoming film on U.S. military pollution, Earth's Greatest Enemy. Mike, welcome to Counterpunch Radio.
Thanks for having me, all.
Mike, it's great to have you with us today. And before we jump into it, we'd love to have you talk some more about your military experience, your time in Iraq, and how you came to anti-war organizing and really became a veteran organizing against U.S. empire. Give us some background.
Sure. Well, I'm from the generation of veterans who were unlucky enough to join right before the 9/11 attacks, 2001. I'm of a very particular wave of soldiers who joined under very different conditions than those who joined in the post 9/11 world, like expecting to go to war. And not only that, but I was in that group that was the first soldiers into Iraq in the invasion in March of 2003. So I would say that I'm my generation, or you could call it the vets generation that I come from, were the ones that came, joined right before 9/11, all of a sudden saw this huge flip to jingoism and militarism and like kind of an excitement about war in general, U.S. population, this kind of surge of I guess you could call it patriotism, but really was just jingoism and like a bloodlust for revenge and things like that. So kind of seeing that transition was like a very jarring and strange thing. But then also being told very point blank that Iraq was this imminent threat to the United States. And I do think a lot of people forget how intense that propaganda was, or a lot of people are too young to have experienced it themselves. But when we were getting ready to go to Iraq, it was, this is an imminent attack. Like Saddam Hussein is going to attack the United States with nuclear or chemical weapons. And so if that's what you're being told day in and day out, especially as a soldier, you're like, oh shit, that's pretty bad. And also a lot of the propaganda at that time was that this is going to be just this great thing for the Iraqi people. And so coupled with that, Saddam is this madman who's going to attack the United States. It was also, he's keeping the Iraqi people in this horrible state of living. And then we're going to make all of that so much better. And so I was part of that group that had that indoctrination, but then went to Iraq and then very quickly saw that all the things that we were told about it were just complete bullshit, right? I mean, no one was even looking for weapons of mass destruction once we got there. And so that went out the window very, very quickly. But then I think for me, I could even accept at that time, like maybe this WMDs thing is bullshit, but the thing that's indisputable is that we're going to give the Iraqis a better life. And then I think that through the course of that year that I was there, seeing that not only was the imminent threat thing fake, but that we were not giving the Iraqis a better life. In fact, we were doing everything to make their lives terrible. And I think really a realization that I didn't really understand until later, but, you know, kind of realizing that I sympathized with the Iraqi resistance, not just innocent Iraqi civilians who were being harmed and lives made terrible by the U.S. occupation, but I completely understood and put myself in the shoes of Iraqis who actually decided to fight the U.S. occupation forces. And then I felt a great understanding and sympathy with all of them. And so I had planned on doing a career in the military. I actually really loved being in the military up until that point. I had all these great plans for my military career, but then the Iraq war shattered my understanding of what that was and turned everything upside down for me. And so I actually, my unit got stop lost. And so I was supposed to be stuck in the military my friends got stuck in for another several years against their will and got sent on more deployments to Iraq. But I was lucky enough to be able to find a way to finagle myself out of that. And so I got out in 2005. And then at that time, I didn't even know that there was a anti-war movement, let alone a veterans anti-war movement. It wasn't until I started college shortly after, that's actually how I finagled my way out, is I got accepted to a university and so was able to use my college to get out of the military. And then, yeah, I first day on campus, I saw someone passing out an anti-war flyer. And I was like, that's cool. I'm against the war also. Went to a local demonstration. But then around that time, there was a organizing for a big march on the Pentagon in 2006. So I went to that. I put on my uniform jacket, like I saw Ron Kovic wear in Born on the 4th of July. And then as soon as I got out of the car, I saw a Vietnam vet wearing the same jacket with the same patch. And I said, oh, there's still you guys around. And then I met a bunch of Iraq war vets at that same demonstration and we marched together. So it was really all over from there. I mean, once I connected, realizing there was a broader movement of veterans who were against the war and people like me who had just come back from it, that became the focus of my life at that point.
And when did you have this sort of, obviously you had this anti-war awakening in a way, but you also became on the left too. And I think it probably is part of your broader sort of critique of US empire, and you witnessed it firsthand, but how did that kind of evolve for you?
Yeah, well, I think the big thing was, you know, one, I had this very specific understanding of the United States and the military, right? And so prior to joining, I mean, granted, I was a child, like I joined the Army when I was 17 and I was in boot camp on my 18th birthday. So these are all the thoughts of a child and what it means to be an American, what the US military is. But you have this view of this great upholder of democracy and freedom and doing good in the world and all that stuff. And the Iraq war like shattered that so much for me that it kind of led me on this journey of trying to get to the bottom of what really happened. Right. And I think for most people, it's really like George W. Bush was this corrupt liar and the Republican Party are terrible, but like that explanation didn't satisfy me because there was a lot of Democrats that were supporting the war. And then I found their critiques of the war, especially early on when the war was getting bad, like the Democrats' critiques of the war was this was just poorly planned. Like we didn't send enough soldiers. We ignored the warnings of certain generals that said we have to be prepared for a long fight. So the critique wasn't that this was a crime to illegally invade a sovereign country and overthrow their government. But it was just critiques that didn't speak to me at all. And so I was obsessed with just trying to understand how this could have happened and how we could have all been betrayed so badly. And that just, I guess, led me down the path of just digging deeper and deeper. And then that inevitably leads you to trying to understand what imperialism is, you know, how the Iraq war was not the first war of aggression by the United States against a sovereign country or to try to determine who runs a certain country or whatever. And then so the more you go down that rabbit hole, I mean, of course, it can lead people in many directions. But the one that spoke to me most was understanding things through an anti-imperialist lens and realizing that there's a deeper systemic problem that leads us to these things and that one that would continue recurring if we didn't address that systemic problem.
Let's fast forward what's going on now. Last month, we learned that the Trump administration is planning on cutting the Veterans Affairs by something like 80,000 employees, which will undoubtedly impact, obviously, healthcare, mental health care. And we're witnessing early mobilization of veterans to oppose these cuts in places where we don't see often veteran mobilization in red states like Kansas, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you're hearing about what you're hearing from veterans about these proposed cuts, and what do you think kind of lies ahead as Trump and Musk continue dismantling these federal agencies that so many of us, including vets, rely on for services?
Yeah, definitely. Before I get into that, just really quickly, I was part of this big generation of Iraq vets who became very active and kind of frontline fighters in the war against Iraq. Of course, that comes from a long history of soldiers being mobilized during times of war, most significantly during Vietnam, where most of the military was mutinous by like 1970. And so there really is and of course that's a deep, long history that is very interesting to me, but of course, too much to get into it at this moment. But I think that first of all, under Trump, that potential still very much exists right now. I mean, Trump is carrying out this shock and awe domestic policy right now. I think other than the tariffs, which just hit, he hasn't yet gotten into his shock and awe foreign policy, which is a very realistic thing. I mean, talking about taking Denmark, I mean, talking about bombing Iran right now. I think, and if the Trump administration does get us into some kind of big conflict, I think that a lot of people kind of dismiss rebellion among soldiers today as well. There's no more draft like there was in Vietnam. The draft could very much become a thing. I mean, the selective service is a thing that they are fine tuning, that they are preparing. The United States, it's not unfeasible that the U.S. could initiate a draft at some point if Trump starts some bullshit. So these are kind of looming dangers that could really revive the tradition that I come from. But in terms of the VA, yes, I mean, veterans are really becoming at this point kind of the frontline fighters against Trump's agenda. There was just a big mobilization in Washington, D.C. And that is because the most treasured right and benefit that veterans have, the VA healthcare system, the disability and compensation system, all of that is under very, very severe attack. And those are things that you're not supposed to touch, right? They have been touching it since Obama. I mean, this really started under Obama. And I guess for people who aren't familiar with this system, the Veterans Administration, like the healthcare administration, it's this huge centralized institution. I can walk into any VA clinic in the country. They immediately recognize me as a patient, pull up all my stuff. I can get seen at any of them. Everything is socialized, I guess you could call it. All of the care is free and medication, things like that. I mean, depending on your disability rating, but it's a great system. And then not only that, but so many veterans rely on some kind of disability payment where you go in the military, your body or your mind is going to get messed up somehow and you get compensation for that. And then so many millions of veterans financially rely on the kind of compensation that they get. What started under Obama was an attempt to privatize this system. So the one benefit of being a veteran is you don't have to deal with the bullshit healthcare system that everyone else has to deal with. They are trying very hard to make us have to deal with that system. And so what has started since Obama, which is now under extreme acceleration, is intentionally understaffing the VA. So there are not enough doctors, there are not enough nurses, there are not enough healthcare professionals or mental health professionals, so that then you have the option of, do you want to wait to see someone at the VA because it's understaffed, or do you want a shorter wait to go to what's called community care, which you can go to a private clinic that then bills the VA, which is more expensive care, and veterans are less happy with that care. So it's worse care for more taxpayer dollars, but you get quicker appointments. It's gotten to the point now where if I go to the VA for any kind of specialty care, they'll say you can get an appointment with the VA in 3 months to a year. Like for dent, I just went for dental. It's a 1 year appointment for 1 year out to make appointments, or you can wait 2 weeks and go to community care. So most people choose community care because they don't want to wait 6 months to get seen by a VA specialist. And this care is very hit or miss. A lot of times it sucks. It's people who have never dealt with vets before. It's a very frustrating experience for veterans to go through. What Trump is doing now is they started with layoffs of like 2,000 so-called non-essential staff. And that was a shock. And everyone was like, in the veterans community was like, this is crazy. You're further understaffing an already understaffed institution. Then they just came out and said, actually, that number is raising to 80,000. And that is just a shocking number. It's a huge percentage of the VA workforce. And it's just going to further make it. I mean, the VA that they envision is like a tiny, tiny VA that only serves like the real veterans, like the guys that lost legs from stepping on a landmine and things like that. And then everyone else just gets pushed out to community care, which, like I said, is more expensive. It's just like a boon for private healthcare. And of course, and then when I mentioned the disability and compensation payments, Hegseth has frequently floated, I mean, when he was at Fox, before he was even considered for Secretary of Defense, this idea that most veterans who receive disability compensation, it's fraudulent. They made shit up. They pretended to have tinnitus. They pretended to have PTSD. And they're just sucking up taxpayer dollars because they scammed the system. And if there's a real potentiality, they could start to audit disability and compensation ratings, which would be going through and trying to find, like in the DOGE fashion, the inefficiencies and people who don't really deserve that the benefits that they have. And so these are very alarming things to anyone who's a veteran, because we really rely on these services. And veterans are not a majority of Americans, but there's about 20 million veterans in America, and many of them are working class and poor people who really rely on these services. And so, yeah, these are not being well received among vets who predominantly voted for Trump. Trump won the veterans community. But that is changing very quickly, I think, because as I said in the beginning, these are like the treasured institutions that you do not touch. And you're not going to meet any veteran who says they prefer going to community care. Then there's a lot of complaints about the VA, mainly from it being understaffed and underfunded. But most people recognize these changes as only making those things worse.
Well, and the implications, right, of two, I mean, you were talking a little bit about the anti-Vietnam era, and PTSD, for example, wasn't a thing that they even talked about. And there's so many aspects of this that's more than just going in for regular care. I mean, the mental health aspect of it is enormous. That those reverberations are going to be longstanding, it seems like.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we want to get into talking some about some more responses to these attacks and the cuts. But before we do that, I wonder if we might take a step back to talk a little bit about the longer history of organizing in the military. You just wrote a great piece for Counterpunch on Pete Hegseth. Hegseth's attacks on Black troops evoke a long history of anti-racist struggle. And of course, Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, the white supremacist, I mean, not hyperbole. Tell us some about who Pete Hegseth has been traveling with. Tell us some about what you talk about in this article and this longer history of organizing within the military. We've talked about the Vietnam veteran era. This, you get into an earlier era here too.
Yeah, well, Hegseth, I mean, he's just, clearly this guy is a white nationalist. These are the people he pals around with, like Jack Posobiec, who you mentioned, Posobiec's just this like neo-Nazi influencer, right? I mean, he's this far right internet guy. He was brought on Hegseth's first international trip. So it's just so out there. It's just off the spectrum. Like these people, Hegseth came in on this platform of de-woking the military, which, you know, the Pentagon has had to adapt to the changing culture in the United States. And so the reason that the Pentagon has introduced DEI initiatives, anti-racist training, the lifting of the ban on transgender soldiers, lifting of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which is the generation that I was in, where I was in under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that being repealed, where you can serve as openly gay in the military, introducing women into combat arms roles that they were previously kept out of. So allowing women roles in infantry units and things like that. The right wing perspective is that, oh, they're making the military woke to try to appeal to these liberals and it's making us less strong and all of these things. But from the Pentagon leadership who spearheaded all these things, their perspective was we need to remain irrelevant as an institution, and we have to change with society to be able to recruit people, to appear palatable, to not just seem like this arch reaction, the arch reactionary institution that it is. The U.S. military is a reactionary institution, but if they are openly that, they're already in a recruiting crisis. It's going to be harder for them to recruit people. It's going to be harder for them to have legitimacy among the American people that just see it as a sexist and homophobic and racist institution. They had to introduce these things and advertise them, have commercials and ad campaigns around the fact that they are welcoming of gay people and trans people and value contributions of Black people and Native people and women to military history. So these are all very real things that the Pentagon did out of necessity as an organization that wants legitimacy among the American public. The right wing sees this as these are making us a weak institution. We're less lethal and all of that bullshit. And so Hegseth came in on this de-woking the military. His angle is that we're going to increase unity by getting rid of any reference. It's really sweeping the kind of stuff that they're doing. It's like they're getting rid of like any honoring of Black soldiers on Army websites, right? So like they remove this page of this Black Medal of Honor winner, right? And this guy clearly deserved the Medal of Honor. He was in some crazy human wave attack where he got wounded three separate times as he like led this defense and this base in the Vietnam. So like people who clearly were deserving, like it was not a DEI Medal of Honor as they changed the URL to DEI Medal of Honor, but it just shows the levels to which it's just a disdain for any recognition of Black service members. They've done the same with Native service members, women. And so there's this kind of purging from like the records and tweets, like making all the branches go and delete tweets that honor Black or women service members and things like that, because it's promoting division by pointing out somebody's race. So, you know, there's that, but I think that there's all of these little things like banning student groups on military academies, so you can't be in like a Black student group anymore, things like that, that were kind of longstanding institutions. You know, that is all under the guise of promoting unity, but it's really, we know who Hegseth is. He does not like Black people. So that's really what's behind that. But the thing that's, I think, the most shocking thing that's come down, I mean, we're not sure where it's going to go yet, but there is this thing in military standards where you got to be clean shaven every day, right? About half of Black servicemen have a skin condition where if you shave with a razor, like you're supposed to shave, you'll get irritation, razor bumps, they're called. And so you can get like what's called a profile where you don't have to clean shave if you have that skin condition. So this has just been a thing always. This is just a thing that has just always been in as long as I've been following the military. Hegseth has ordered a review of that policy, basically saying that if you have that skin condition, you can be discharged from the military, which is wild because that's really saying that half of Black men in the military can be kicked out, medically discharged against their will. And I think that is clearly because they'd want to get Black people out of the military. I mean, the people like Hegseth and Jack Posobiec, I mean, someone who's, I guess, an informal advisor to him. These are just things that make white nationalists like salivate. Like they love that this kind of stuff is happening. And so, yeah, I mean, the article that you all published was taking that as this kind of potential flashpoint to remind people that the military has really been a center of a civil rights struggle for like almost the entire history of the United States. I mean, we start just the really quick version is like you have the Civil War, where like the first major civil rights struggle in America outside of abolition was the right for Black men to be able to join the U.S. military in the Civil War to go fight the Confederates. And there was complete resistance to that in American society. And it really took heroic soldiers who were under like abolitionist military leaders, right? I recommend everyone watch the movie Glory, because it's like the country didn't want Black men to serve in uniform because Black men with guns is a scary thing, even in the free liberal North. And then so you have a abolitionist like the governor of Massachusetts, who was able to bring up his own unit to send to the Civil War of Black soldiers with actually his son, Shaw, was the one who led the unit. And then knew these soldiers knew that they just had to prove their capability and heroism in battle to be able to win this right. And so hundreds of Black soldiers died on these kind of debacle doomed assaults just to prove that they had the ability to fight. And this won the right for Black men to join the military federally and became a decisive factor in the Civil War. And while that was happening, they were also, once they were in the military, they waged strikes and mutinies and all sorts of rebellions against the racist treatment that they received once they had won the right to be in the military. And these were carried out during the course of the Civil War. But then you have the struggle to desegregate the military, which, you know, really took place prior to World War II, but accelerated after it, where the kind of next major civil rights struggle, in fact, what is considered the opening salvo of the civil rights movement, was the struggle to desegregate the military. And you had Black sailors writing open letters, reporting on racist conditions in the Navy and things like that, that really became flashpoints for the civil rights struggle in the United States and directly led into the struggle to desegregate education and things like that. And this continued through the Vietnam War, where Vietnam veterans became like a backbone of the civil rights movement there as well. And then the experiences of Black veterans being able to organize self-defense against white riots, like especially in Red Summer, places like Tulsa. It was Black World War I veterans that used their military training to be able to repel those assaults. And so, yeah, I mean, really the oppression of Black service members has always had reverberations throughout the broader civil rights struggle. And I think that if they're going to be accelerating attacks again in this manner, it has that same potential. And, you know, kind of the same thing is true for the LGBTQ movement. I mean, I think that like the first ever gay rights protest in America was in the 50s, and it was protesting outside a U.S. Army recruiting station, protesting the Army's policy of kicking people out for being gay, but then telling everyone and telling their employers and making that information public. And of course, the first ever kind of major magazine, this is in the 70s, that Time magazine published a man in Air Force uniform saying, "I am a homosexual." It was like, this was the gay rights movement breaking out into the mainstream was done through soldiers and service members. And kind of in the same way, the civil rights struggle used the prestige of being in the military as a way to advance freedom and their cause. And so these two sectors that are becoming under increasing attack by these bigots who are running the military now, there's a precedent for that kind of being a spark for those struggles actually getting strength and popularity and advancing.
Yeah, I really recommend people go check out the article. It's really useful. Thanks for writing it. I think, especially in this moment, you feel like the ruling class doesn't know their history very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's a good thing, I guess.
Right.
Well, and I'm wondering about, let's move on to like anti-war organizing now, especially with this ongoing genocide in Gaza. While there's not U.S. combat troops on the ground, there are special forces veterans there, which I don't think a lot of people know about. There's at least 100. Of course, U.S. military intelligence has been working really closely with the IDF in Israel to carry out the genocide. And we've seen a smattering of dissent among military personnel here in the U.S. Of course, Aaron Bushnell's self-immolation made waves. But there seems to be also like this simmering movement among active duty as well as vets against the genocide. I mean, for a lot of us that have been going to protests and things, I've seen veterans at protests that are talking about this. So I'm kind of wondering how you're viewing some of this as far as organizing goes. And given these vicious attacks on free speech that are happening under the Trump administration, how can veterans play a role in this anti-genocide movement?
Yeah, well, I will say that Hegseth is not popular in the military right now anyway. I mean, if we get 8 years of Hegseth, he will have succeeded in remaking the military into the military he wants, of getting all the people out that are woke and really making it an openly reactionary fascist institution. And so if his agenda goes forward for some amount of time, the people who don't like that stuff will get out. The people who like it will start joining. And then it will kind of make it the dream that white nationalists have. They will get their dream military. But right now, he's not very popular. And when you people in the military who are not exactly political, people who may not care about Palestine or people that don't have a ton of issues with U.S. foreign policy, at base level, the kind of attitude is, well, these are clearly unconstitutional things that this administration is carrying out. I think one of the things that really made big waves was when the White House promoted that image of Trump wearing the crown. You know, he was the king, and there was all this, we had a revolution against the king. And so these things really kind of fit into the, I think, what's the dominant ideology in the military of like, we are defenders of democracy and the Constitution. And so even under that kind of base level mindset of service members, you can really look at what's happening as a crisis of democracy, a crisis of the Constitution. And so that's something that, you know, creates a lot of potential in terms of like who is sympathetic with the movement against Trump and his administration as individuals. How much this bleeds into foreign policy has really yet to be seen. I think one thing that is a constant is in every single U.S. war or engagement or whatever, you are going to have some number of service members who oppose it, who that becomes a catalyst, a wake-up moment for them to turn against U.S. policy and rebel in some form or another. So this didn't happen in a mass scale like it did in Vietnam or even the Iraq War so far with the Gaza genocide, but there has been a significant number of service members who Aaron Bushnell, of course, being the most high profile, but so many who either played some kind of direct role. Like there is one, a former Army pilot who we just interviewed for our video portion of Eyes Left, which is on Breakthrough News, who was flying missions in Egypt, realized he was somehow supporting the Gaza genocide and quit the military over that. But hundreds of service members have applied for conscientious objector, citing Gaza as the main reason. And so you do have some level of rebellion and resistance. And of course, many in the active duty have joined the demonstrations for Palestine. And so they always are a part of the movement, whether people know it or not. The question is when that has the potential to really grow into something more significant, like happened in Vietnam and like happened to, I think, a significant degree during the Iraq War. And that is really dependent on what happens with foreign policy, which it could go a bunch of different directions right now. But I think in terms of, if we're just talking about support for Israel, I think it's a trickle, but it's happening. I mean, you're having people get out of the military all the time because this is what has woken them up to what the US's role is in the world and also what their role is in relation to Israel. And I think that's a thing that's going to continue happening. And I think Trump is making that more fertile ground, because not only do you have this kind of open support for Israeli genocide, but then you have just outright bigots and extremists who are now implementing all these policies in the army, which is stuff like no more interesting food at the chow hall during cultural heritage months, because that's woke. And so you're going to have the same shitty menu year round. It's not going to change month to month based on what culture we're honoring. So, you know, that's not going to cause people to mutiny, but it does create growing conditions of just disdain for the leadership. And that's always a first step to rebellion, is hating your leadership. And then whatever happens next is, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like the signal gate thing, right? Like,
yeah,
hopefully that bleeds into a critique of what the hell are we, why are we bombing Yemen, right? But mm-hmm. It seems they're obviously like the disgust with leadership that they would even put troops at risk in this way.
Yeah, I mean, that's that drove so much of the anti-Iraq war movement among soldiers, right? It was like George W. Bush, this guy is some idiot, silver spoon kid was handed everything in life and was basically handed the presidency that he did not actually win. You got Dick Cheney, who's this obviously corrupt Halliburton executive who's just giving contracts to his own fucking company. People like Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, that like these people were just seen as like buffoon liars who were just super rich, who were profiting off of this, all that stuff. And the kind of hatred of that leadership is what kind of was the first step into so many people being like, okay, well, we hate them. We actually hate what we're doing. That's all connected. And yeah. And so it's Hegseth, of all people, being seen among soldiers in big part as someone who's undeserving to be in the position, someone who's bad at his job, like doing something as stupid as the signal gate thing. He's kind of acknowledged as like a drunk among the service members that I see and like online forums and things like that. And so not a very well-respected guy, despite the fact that he's a vet himself. And of course, Trump advance have their own drawbacks that make people not like them. In Trump's first term, when Trump assassinated Soleimani, and there was a very real possibility that we were going to enter into a war with Iran, I, just through my small networks of doing the Eyes Left podcast, right? I mean, I had dozens of listeners who were in the active duty military contact me in those like 3-day period after the assassination, saying that they would absolutely not participate in a war against Iran and wanted to know their options for what they could do to get out of that. And that was the most people I had ever had contact me ever in all of my years doing this work. And so I think that just shows, if there was something like big like that to happen, there would immediately be some layer of service members who would rebel against it in some form or another. And so that's something that's always there. And I think a question for people on the left is, how do you prepare for that potentiality? How do you prepare for that moment actually happening? Which in a lot of ways is recognizing that a lot of those people are already in the struggle and acknowledging that and finding ways to understand and build with those people.
Lastly, before we let you go, I'd love to talk about your upcoming film that you did with Abby, Earth's Greatest Enemy. I know you've been working on this for quite a while. Do you want to talk about the film a little bit without spoiling it, of course? Mm-hmm. I know you traveled around the world really to film for this, and I know a little bit about it, and I'm really excited about it to come out. So can you share a little bit about the project?
Yeah, well, I think the way that this started is I always heard that fact, the U.S. military is the world's biggest polluter, you know? And so I think that's on the left. It's a phrase that most people know. And I think the fact to back it up is that the Pentagon is the largest institutional consumer of fossil fuels, right? So the Pentagon uses about 260,000 barrels of oil a day just for military activities, which ranks it like among countries like number 140 or something like that, officially, according to their official numbers. And so a bigger polluter than a bigger polluter than 140 countries. It ranks it high up in the national data. And not only that, but those numbers are exempt from climate agreements. So when the U.S. goes to COP, all of the international agreements where every country says we're going to cut our emissions by this much, it exempts the military. It doesn't count the military, which means it's just fake. So the promise for net zero by whatever, the U.S. lobbied to make sure that military emissions were not counted. And so it's this kind of hidden thing that people know about. So anyways, we knew that this was a fact. And so we thought, you know, let's look into this. Let's see what this story is about the U.S. military being the biggest polluter. So it kind of started out as a project that just looked at its emissions. And of course, the emissions that are the official that I mentioned is just the tip of the iceberg. The actual carbon output of the military is at least five times higher than the official numbers. But as we show in the film, the number is so much bigger than even that. And so the amount of just carbon emissions being the number one concern for us right now in terms of climate collapse, the need to quickly get off of fossil fuels and completely change the way that we run as a society. That being an essential thing, and the impact that the U.S. military has in that as an actual emitter, and also standing in the way of that happening, transitioning off a fossil fuel economy, this whole infrastructure of the U.S. military really just being existing to prop up capitalism, which runs on fossil fuels and does not want to get off of it. And so there's that kind of indirect role that they play as well. But then once you look into this topic of military pollution, there's so many other ways that it pollutes. Josh, as you know, you have a whole book about it. Looking at just the impact of the nuclear weapons program, the continued production of nuclear weapons, that poses a great danger to humanity. Not just the use of them, but the chemical fallout, as you wrote about in your book. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because there's so many other types of toxic waste and contaminants that every single military base in the country and in the world releases into environments. And so as climate change restricts the number of places we can live, right, places that will become too hot to live, coastal areas that are popular that people can no longer live in, as places become harder to live in, what is the condition of the places that people will have to resort to living in? And military bases make it such that it's not healthy to live near a military base. And so the film goes into that as well. It goes into the impacts of warfare itself, the toxic fallout from munitions that when a country is bombed or has a lot of firefights in it, the legacy of that, but also in training, anywhere where there's military training, you are releasing vaporized heavy metals into the environment that has a real serious health impact. You have the destruction of habitats. And in many cases, habitats for hundreds of endangered species, really precious ecosystems that are just bulldozed to make room for new military bases. And so you have all these kind of interlocking elements that really kind of paint a picture of like, what is the angle of the film is, what is the real cost of having the biggest military ever in human history? Well, the ecological cost of having the biggest military ever is a big one. Carbon emissions is just part of it. There's all these other facets to it. And that's what we explore in the film by going on the ground to a lot of these places, meeting with victims, meeting with kind of the premier experts on studying this stuff. And yeah, so we've been working on it for a long time and we're almost done. And so it's going to be out this summer. We're currently in the early stages of planning a screening tour around the country. And I think our perspective in filmmaking, right? So this is our second film. We made a film called Gaza Fights for Freedom, which people may have seen. And that the experience doing our first film, I think what really moved us about that is we set out to do this, but didn't expect how it would go. As we sought to make something like a tool for organizers, right? What's something that can be a crash course on a topic that you can introduce new people to it, help them understand, but also be able to organize around, organize meetings around, bring organizations into a coalition to show something, to study something. And that happened with our Gaza film it's still every week I'm hearing of another screening that is like a community organizing initiative, and that film being able to be used as an organizing tool. And so
even in Israel, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah. That's some people got arrested for it, yeah. or raided for it. So yeah, so we're just really moved by that. And so our number one goal in making this film was to do something similar, to make something that can be used as a community organizing tool, to bridge the movement against war and militarism with the climate change and environmentalist movement. And so that's our big hope, is that this film can also be used as something that brings together organizations and activists and is used to kind of build the struggle around saving the planet and ending imperialism. And the kind of really necessary thing of bridging those two topics together. And so, yeah, so when we release it, our plan is to just release a nationwide community screening tour. And that'll be the first phase of it, where we'll travel around and show the film in many cities as we can, working with local anti-war and environmental organizations. And so we're shooting for August to be the beginning of that.
Brilliant. This sounds so good. I feel like that is such a needed resource for both the environmental movement and the anti-war movement. I mean, something that two movements that have to be much more strongly together on this. So really looking forward to that.
Thanks. Yeah. And I think the biggest challenge has been that it's such a big topic.
Yeah.
And we could have easily made a film about any one of the topics. And so the hardest thing was the first cut of the film we did was over 3 hours long. And then we said, there's no way we can make people sit through a 3-hour movie. And so now we're cutting it down to 2 hours, which is hard, but we wanted to stick to the plan to try to cover every single angle that is relevant, because we want to give people a full picture. And I think there are great films about certain elements of military pollution and military harm to the environment that are focused on a specific place. This one place in Colorado that has a lot of pollution and there's high cancer rates in the community. There's a great film called Sonic Seas about the impact of Navy sonar on whales and marine mammals. And it's a great film. These are all great films, but we wanted to pack everything into one to really hit people over the head with the idea. There are a lot of different ecological impacts. It is not worth having a massive military like this. And in fact, if we want to solve the climate crisis, we can't with the military that is standing in the way of it, and also being this huge polluting institution that it is. So yeah, that's the hardest part, has been trying to fit everything into one film. Hopefully it's good and we've succeeded in that. At this point, I don't know, but we're looking forward to getting some feedback very soon once we start screening.
I'm really excited about this film for a lot of reasons, but as someone that has been involved in anti-war organizing and in the environmental movement, there's often this divide, right, between things. And I've seen it really with the cause for Palestine. I mean, the environmental movement has been pretty much silent as far as the ecocide that has happened in Gaza, mm-hmm. which has been perpetuated on purpose by Israel to make large sections of Gaza unlivable. And the environmental movement has basically been completely silent on this. There is this crazy divide, and I'm really hopeful that your film with Abby can kind of bridge that gap.
Yeah, I mean, even just look at Greta Thunberg, you know, went from being like the hero of the climate change movement to being like kind of shunned and like and completely attacked for wanting to care about something else and pointing out that there's kind of these are interlocking issues and you can't care about one without caring about the other. And so, yeah, I mean, it is a thing that, of course, we feel is needed. I think that most people will care if they have the information. I mean, obviously there's this issue of like the major climate organizations and funding and all of these things that maybe prevent them from being critical of the Pentagon and things like that. And so our hope is that to make a strong case that you have to acknowledge it. And one thing that I, not to spoil too much, but there's kind of direct impact, but then there's what role should we expect the military to serve as a climate crisis gets worse, right? And I mean, and that's another angle of it as well. And so, you know, this idea that there's actually an army recruiting commercial for the National Guard targeting young people with climate anxiety and saying that, hey, there's going to be floods, there's going to be heat waves, you can join the National Guard and save people from floods in your community when there's climate crisis, natural disasters and things like that. That's kind of the marketing, but what really will be the role that the Pentagon serves as there's water shortages and food prices are skyrocketing and things like that. And we can look at the record and assume that it's not going to be good, but they're waiting to critique an institution that will very quickly become your enemy is probably not smart either.
If you could just jump in and let us know again where people can follow you and follow this, the film. I think it's going to be key for many different sectors of organizing. So let us know.
Yeah. So you can just go to earthsgreatestenemy.com. The website's being updated. So right now it's not a great one, but it will be soon. But the better way would probably just to be follow our socials, which is just at Empire Files on Twitter and Instagram. And then all of the announcements about screenings and stuff will be popping up there. And then if you are in an area where you'd like to host a screening, there's information posted there about how you can do that. So you fill out an interest form and then we'll be in touch about how you can bring, because first it's going to be just in theaters in the first phase of the release. And so if you want to host a community screening, there's ways to sign up on a list and we'll help you organize that in the coming months.
That's great. Mike. And also people go to Empire Files Substack, subscribe, support Empire Files. They're a fantastic media organization. I'm sure you're all familiar with them already. If not, go check it out. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. Don't show it.